The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Oh, now that's a classic. The sound of a never-fail 1963 1200cc air-cooled engine in a Volkswagen Beetle. It's the putt-putt rhythm track of my youth. My dad bought a Volkswagen bus in 1963, and when I was old enough to drive in the mid-70s, I got a white 1963 Beetle for $150. That sound, Volkswagen and trust, never fail, except the heater. It never really worked. Those days are gone for VW now that the company has admitted to selling cars that have microchips installed to make it look like the cars are less polluting than they really are. VW has some work to do to get trust back and some splaining to do to the government. We'll talk about that this hour. Also this hour, keeping Syrians safe in Syria. A U.S. senator has a radical proposal. We'll also find out what he thinks about a possible Muslim U.S. president now that candidate Ben Carson has raised the issue. China competes with the Pope for attention in the U.S., and a young girl tells a survival story and tells us that telling the story was finally how she survived. But first, here's a war cry to make our enemies tremble in fear.
Our determination is that, as you know very well, we can defend against ISIL and al-Nusra under the 2001 AUMF. And if our forces are attacked by the regime in a particular circumstances, the president could exercise his Article 2 rights under the Constitution.
Article 2 rights, man, they're scared over there in Syria. That's Christine Warmoth, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy on Capitol Hill, describing the various authorizations the administration believes it has to use force in Syria. Well, Democratic Senator Tim Kaine is tired of the acronyms and foggy mission statements from the Obama administration regarding the situation in Syria, and he wants a new strategy, humanitarian or safe zones for opposition fighters within the country as refugees pour into the U.S. and Europe. And the senator is here to discuss it further. Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat from Virginia, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, John, great to be with you.
What would it take to make these safe zones, and where would they be?
John, what you would need to do, and I don't underestimate the challenge of doing it, but I think it's the best alternative, is you would need to take area that the anti-Assad and anti-ISIL forces have been able to clear in northern Syria and try to extend that, protect it militarily, largely through a no-fly zone, but then use the combined weight of the nations of the world and international NGOs to provide food, medical care, and basic necessities of life in northern Syria along the Turkish border. I wasn't initially a supporter, but after I was over in the region in February of 2014 and saw the number of refugees pouring into Lebanon and Jordan, I have been urging the administration to consider this. Most recently, Senators McCain, Graham, Durbin, and I wrote the administration earlier this year to say this was going to be preferable to the escalating millions of people who are leaving Syria and pouring into neighboring countries and now spreading out across Europe.
Well, here's Senator John McCain posing that question at a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing last week, and it doesn't sound like the Pentagon wants to go there.
Would you support a buffer zone which would then protect some of these refugees who are being barrel-bombed and slaughtered by Bashar Assad?
I don't see the force available to be able to protect them currently, sir, so I would not recommend it at this point.
We don't have the troops over there, so you want an escalation to get to that point. How many boots on the ground are we talking about here?
Well, we do have partners, John. The important thing is Turkey has been asking us to do this with them for quite a while, and other nations in the region, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and others have indicated that as well. My sense is this is something that could be done with U.S. Air cover and troops from other nations that are in the region. Because those are the nations that are most affected by this massive humanitarian crisis. If we're going to try to arrest this flow, we need to do something where people will feel safe to go home. And I was with Syrian refugees in Gaziantep, Turkey, about 2 months ago, and many of them want to go back and will go back if they can be in a place where their safety is secure.
Well, I'm trying to put myself into the mind of one of those refugees in Gaziantep, Turkey, and I have a hard time distinguishing between a better life in some crowded safe zone that's not actually my home, which may you know, be a place that I'm stuck for years and years and years versus the same kind of situation in Lebanon or Turkey versus, you know, throwing the dice and seeing if I can't find a decent life, just basically give up on Syria and, you know, move to Germany or Sweden or maybe even Los Angeles.
John, I think the purpose of the humanitarian safe zone is not to say that somebody in Syria couldn't seek refuge elsewhere, but so the idea is you don't do this and then block people from leaving, but it's to give people the option of staying in their country in a place that's safer. And I am convinced that many Syrians would take that. And again, most recently in Gaziantep, a city that's right near the Turkish-Syrian border that has huge numbers of Syrian refugees, there's a deep desire to go back. Actually, a lot of folks cross the border already. It's a dangerous border crossing. They're trying to establish town councils in areas that are safe and participate in what they hope will be the next chapter of a better next chapter of life in Syria. And they feel like they can contribute to that more if they are in their country in a safe place than if they're hundreds or thousands of miles away.
It seems to me a safe zone strategy is essentially a surrender to ISIS, basically saying, OK, you guys stay over there. We won't bother you. You just don't bother us over here in these safe zones. It sounds like partition of Syria. Surrender to ISIS, and we're done.
Well, you led into the intro with the testimony from the recent Armed Services Committee hearing. I think the Obama administration's legal rationale for the war against ISIS is very flimsy. I actually do believe that U.S. military should be used against ISIS. I just don't think it should be used against ISIS without a vote of Congress. But I would envision the safe zone as a humanitarian zone. If you are fleeing ISIS, if you are fleeing al-Nusra, if you are fleeing Bashar al-Assad, if you're fleeing hunger, if you're fleeing cholera, you can come there, and with the support of the NGO community, basic life necessities will be met. But outside of that safe zone, we will continue to work together with partners against ISIS. We've had some success in Syria in the north. That's going to go on. So, no, there's not going to be a backing off of the battle against ISIL. We'll need to protect people in the safe zone from ISIL.
Senator Tim Kaine, I've got two questions just because they're in the national conversation right now. You can choose how you want to answer them. Would you be comfortable with a Muslim being president of the United States?
Absolutely. There's a constitutional provision that says there's not a religious test for public office in the United States. And
could a Muslim be elected president in 2016?
Well, given that there's no Muslim running for president that I know of in 2016, I think that's unlikely. But
that's the easy way out of the question. That's good. That's right.
but we're a diverse, we are a very diverse nation. And I see it in my home state of Virginia all the time. You know, look, it would be a challenging thing now were a Muslim to run, just like when the first Catholic was nominated for President Al Smith in the late 1920s. It was very challenging for him, and he didn't win. Now that there would be a Catholic nominee is not something that it would be controversial at all. I'm aware of this history because I'm Catholic, and that makes this week exciting because we're waiting for the Pope to come. I'm assuming there probably will be a Muslim candidate for president one day, and the first one will probably face an uphill battle. But then, you know, the second candidate, it will not be much of an issue.
Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat from Virginia, thanks so much.
Okay, thanks, John.
Volkswagen, once the world's most trusted car company, at one point seems to have decided that the best thing for its loyal customers would be to make cars that lie to EPA regulators about their emissions and fuel efficiency. The lie is in the software of 11 million diesel vehicles that tell inspectors the cars are more fuel efficient than they really are. But during normal driving situations, the cars actually can spew up to 40 times as much pollution as allowed under the Clean Air Act. Brian Dickerson, Detroit Free Press columnist. Your first VW?
John, my first VW is the vehicle I own now. I bought it in January 2014. I'm a VW virgin.
And mine was a 1963 white Beetle, which I bought in the 70s for about $150. I'm devastated by this.
I'm betrayed. VW has made me a liar and a polluter, two things I never wanted to be.
And, you know, what do you think this does to the brand? You've written about this disheartening, you know, emotional connection to a car. You know, we all have emotional connections to cars, but what does that translate in terms of business models and sales, that sort of thing?
Well, all the evidence is it's killing their stock price. It's killing the resale value of their diesel vehicles. I assume all of their vehicles. It's so much worse than the other things car companies have admitted to in the last year or two. This wasn't a safety defect that somebody discovered belatedly and tried to cover up. This was deception built into the design of the vehicle.
And it raises some pretty disturbing issues here, Brian. Now, if that chip can tell the EPA that the emissions are well under the federal standards, can it also tell me that I need a new brake system when I don't, and that I should go to my VW dealer and buy one when I don't need one?
You know, software has as much integrity as the people who design it, is my understanding of what software is. And so, yeah, I mean, it exposes our vulnerability in all kinds of ways.
Is there any regulation on what the chips must say when it says, you know, your engine light comes on and you need servicing? I mean, if that's just a timer or it relates in no way to measuring the capability and qualities of the engine, can't the government say something about that?
Well, I suspect that it's illegal for a manufacturer or a dealership to tell you you need service or you need a replacement product that you don't need. I assume that's fraud, however the message is conveyed to you. But John, I would love to talk to people who say we have too much regulation in this country and we don't need to regulate manufacturers like automakers. If this is what happens when regulators are watching closely what's going on in industries where there's no attempt to monitor what the manufacturer is doing.
Well, I mean, it's exactly like the HAL situation in 2001. HAL said that the antenna needed to be replaced, and it didn't need to be replaced. I mean, the car could get mad at you and say, oh, you got plenty of fuel there, Brian. Plenty of fuel. Just keep driving, buddy. And then, boom.
And John, weren't you, as a loyal VW customer, weren't you hoping that the CEO would come on and say, listen, we have this crazy guy in our software department. He's mad at the company and he designed this in. But no, they seem to be conceding, yeah, we did this and now we've got caught and we've been caught and we feel very badly about it. And we hope you'll give us another chance.
Brian Dickerson from the Detroit Free Press. He's a columnist and a VW owner. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks, John.
Xi Jinping in the United States. Are the Xi Jinping T-shirts and bobblehead dolls of the Chinese leader going like hotcakes as he arrives in the U.S. today for a week-long first state visit for the Communist Party chief? Not hardly. Well, leader and Chinese President Xi Jinping will have a hard time competing with the opium for the masses in Pope Francis and the millions of faithful who will be mobbing him on the East Coast. But the U.S.-China relationship probably trumps the U.S. relationship with the Vatican, even now. China has been playing tough on human rights lately, tough on cybersecurity, and tough in its anti-American rhetoric in the midst of a series of confrontations taking place in the South China Sea. Bonnie Glaser is a senior advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Welcome back, Bonnie.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Are the Chinese leaders playing a nationalist card within China because of the economic instability and the loss of the wealth effect in the stock market with all of its volatility, trying to rally the country around some of these tough issues that will make it much less a flexible moment for Xi Jinping here in the United States?
Well, I think that the volatility in the economy and stock market in China don't help, but nationalism in China has been rising over the last few years. It is certainly encouraged by the government. So it's really nothing new at this particular juncture. I do think that Xi Jinping's ability to compromise is difficult. It's restricted. But nevertheless, the U.S.-China relationship is incredibly important for China. The trade relationship, the fact that the United States remains the sole superpower, just critically important. And so I do think it's also an opportunity for Xi Jinping to maybe find a way to tamp down some of the friction.
Can President Obama offer some leverage in the form of, you know, this sole superpower idea that you just raised. It seems to me that it's in China's interest to be recognized as maybe the number two superpower here, and that if the U.S. made gestures in that direction, that China would be more flexible on human rights issues. Are there ways to adjust the optics so that it looks like China is indeed a superpower right along with the United States?
Well, I don't think that making concessions to China is going to convince the Chinese to do the kinds of things that we want, particularly on the human rights agenda. I think we have very little leverage over China's domestic policies. We have somewhat more on their external policies. But I believe at this particular time, it's important for the administration not just to talk tough, but to really follow through and create some costs for the Chinese. After all, President Obama has been talking with Xi Jinping about problems with stealing American intellectual property by use of cyber since 2009, and we have seen absolutely no progress. In fact, the problem's really gotten worse. And in maritime spaces like the South China Sea, the Chinese simply say the United States has no role on this issue and that their actions are legal and legitimate and reasonable. So I really think this is an opportunity for the president to send his concerns very clearly to the Chinese and lay out potential consequences if they don't change their behavior.
Would the Chinese do anything different if there were sanctions laid out on the table? I mean, the response in the past has been, oh, now you're back to containment. You're trying to contain us in the Pacific, contain us in terms of economic growth, using environmental policy to contain our industrial might. We want none of it.
Well, there is a narrative in China that the United States is trying to contain it. Certainly, they see pressure from the United States. But frankly, I think that they see this administration as a little bit weak, unwilling to back up its threats with real hard policies. And in fact, I think they're more worried about the next administration than they are about the Obama administration. So we have to strike the right balance. The United States needs to cooperate with China where our interests converge. But in areas where the Chinese are pursuing policies that are detrimental to the United States and to stability in the region, I do think that we have to start actually taking some actions. I think the Chinese understand toughness. We've seen this in their behavior in past years. So I do think this is a time for the United States to get it right with China and follow up on some of the threats that have been made. In the cyber area, the president now has an executive order where he can impose sanctions on the Chinese. And the Chinese have said that any Chinese company that violates the laws of China will be subject to legal liability, and that these laws include stealing foreign companies' intellectual property. So if the United States has evidence that they are doing this, the Chinese should prosecute. And if they don't, then we should follow up with our own sanctions.
Bonnie Glaser is Senior Advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
The pendulum has made a swing regarding the criminal justice system in America. Where there was once a consensus that aggressive sentencing and long incarceration was the solution to America's crime problems, today there is bipartisan initiative to reduce the prison population, modify sentencing and parole, and enact broad criminal justice reform. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick says it's suddenly strike while the iron is hot time on Capitol Hill. But even he is surprised by the lawmakers choosing to strike together.
There are more than 2.2 million people incarcerated in America. That's one out of every 110 adults in jail or prison. Many millions more are on probation or parole, and still millions more have criminal records. You've heard a lot about the size of the problem, but what might shock you is that dysfunctional, partisan, ugly Washington has been working for more than a year to do something about it. If you need proof, here's President Barack Obama.
The United States is home to 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners. Think about that.
And House Speaker John Boehner.
It's expensive to house prisoners sometimes, frankly. Some of these people are in there under what I'll call flimsy reasons.
Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul.
I think that America has to take a different attitude. I'd like to see more rehabilitation and less incarceration.
Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz.
We are all unified in saying common sense reforms need to be enacted to our criminal justice system.
And Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders.
So we need real reforms in criminal justice. Our goal should not be to put more and more people in jail. It should be figuring out ways that we keep people out of jail.
How is it that they all agree on the need for reform? Why now? We spoke yesterday to several former inmates about the difficulty of rebuilding their lives when a criminal record follows them. Really, that was just one small aspect of a long list of things that could be about to get reformed. What's expected to be a broad reform effort, prison conditions, sentencing policy, the rights of released felons, nonviolent drug crimes, and bail policy. But what's fascinating is that in such a hyper-partisan, dysfunctional environment, politicians have been able to take something as divisive and controversial as crime, punishment, and criminal justice and reach consensus on the need for change. Here's how.
That is a huge moment. We've not been at a moment like this when we've had so many divergent groups and interests that have agreed on such an overarching issue.
That's Nicole Austin Hillary. She's director and counsel of the Washington, D.C. office of the Brennan Center for Justice.
We are going to get something done. You have members of Congress from both sides of the aisle. You have advocates, advocates who represent progressives, who represent conservatives, who represent libertarians. You have religious leaders. You have law enforcement leaders. All of these varying interest groups are all around the table talking about what kinds of reform can be done.
Hillary says that one big factor here is that violent crime rates are low, really low, about half of what they were in 1994. And that gives politicians the space and flexibility to act. Crime rates are low. People are less afraid of crime. They're not demanding that elected officials get tough on crime either. And here's another factor, cost. The overall cost of incarceration is staggering. Cory Booker is a liberal Democratic senator from New Jersey who's been teaming up with conservatives on several aspects of reform. He says that crime rates and cost paint a bigger picture.
We have enough data now to see that there's really no correlation between the numbers of people we're putting into prisons and the crime rate. We also know that there's many red states in America, like Georgia, who are lowering their prison population and lowering their crime rate. In fact, multiple states are now showing that you could achieve both. And so the data is clear right now. It's not as simple as saying that we have overall lower crime rates than we had before, but we have a lot of data that shows that there is a much smarter way to go about it.
And there's another important factor, the war on drugs, or maybe it's better to say the failure of the war on drugs. Politicians aren't necessarily more lax about drugs, but there is a broad consensus now that the incarceration-heavy, zero-tolerance policies of the war on drugs were a failure. And one key voice here have been the libertarians.
Some of the first voices that we heard talk about the fact that we need to make changes to the criminal justice system. Some of the first forays to reach out to folks on the other side of the aisle to talk about these issues came from the libertarian Rand Paul.
That's Nicole Austin Hillary.
For instance, just within the last 2 years, actually worked with the Brennan Center on the issue of vote restoration. He has a bill out right now that tries to deal with the issue of people that were formerly incarcerated having their right to vote restored. So I think some of the initial leadership, some of the initial outreach that came from folks in the libertarian circles. And I think that opened the door and made it easier for individuals from some of the other parts of the conservative community to actually come forward and say, yes, we think we can have conversations. We think we can talk.
Conservative Republican Texas Senator John Cornyn is a former state Supreme Court judge, and it's safe to call him a law and order Republican. He agrees that lower crime rates, successful reforms in the states, and an overall sense of injustice in the system have all conspired to make this point a moment of opportunity for reform. Cornyn says that lawmakers in the fractious Senate are close to agreeing on the starting ingredients for broad reform.
I think here again we're going to have to show the majority leader that this is something that's not going to eat up a bunch of time and end up in failure, but it's likely to have a positive outcome. And I think given the strange, in many ways, coalition of forces coming together to support this reform bill, I think we can do that.
Not end up in failure, Cornyn says, and that's key. The players are positive here, but there are still plenty of pitfalls. Despite the good feelings, there is lots of disagreement still on what a reform bill should look like. One example, Booker and his allies want deep reforms to mandatory minimum sentences in federal courts. Cornyn, who has a lot of say, is skeptical, and he's not alone. This is a big sticking point in negotiations. But there are risks outside the Capitol, too. Those low violent crime rates we talked about, they are low overall. But over the last 6 months, major upswings in violent crime in dozens of cities across the country. If voters get nervous about crime, their politicians can get nervous about being seen as going soft on crime. And that could be a risk to the remarkable but delicate consensus around criminal justice reform. Nicole Austin Hillary.
I will say that I think if we can't get something done at a moment like this, with so many varied voices and groups around the table, I find it difficult to think of another moment where we could actually get something done. The stars are aligned right now. Everybody who has a care or a concern about this issue is around the table again.
Lawmakers in the Senate say they're hoping to debate their reform bill this fall.
And Todd Zwillick will be there on Capitol Hill to cover those debates. He's our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Yesterday afternoon, a very small, frizzy-haired teenager you could easily imagine on a high school soccer team or arguing over a pop song playlist with her girlfriends plopped herself down in our studio to tell us a story of violence and fear.
Do you think my relationship with him is like a drug or like an addiction?
Yes, I do. I think it's a drug that you can't seem to stop.
Rainey was 14 when she started a relationship with a 20-year-old man that seemed to meet her needs for companionship and sanctuary from an unstable family. What she walked into, though, was an emotional prison of violence and verbal abuse. The story only came out when Rainey started working for Radio Rookies, which is produced by our partner WNYC. Her story told it all, the breakups, the reunions, and the isolation from friends and family. Rainey at one point asked her mother about how this relationship had changed her behavior.
You want it, you know it's no good for you, and you want it, you want to caress it, you want to hold it, you want to be in your body, to be next to your body. You want to suck in every minute thinking it's life, and then when it's over, you feel that it's not.
Does my behavior remind you of in any way of your own?
Absolutely. Just like me. Only mine was with the drugs, and I couldn't stay away.
One voice you do not hear in this documentary that has been broadcast nationally on This American Life is the voice of her violent former boyfriend. Rainey was torn over whether to contact him for this story. There was so much she wanted to know from him, but so much fear of the power he might still have over her.
I did want to interview him, because I did want to hear what he would say, but honestly, I would just hear more just crap, honestly, because like his friends or other people who've heard his side of the story will be like, he said he just pushed you, or I don't know why you were screaming. He said he only did this. Like, well, I only tapped her. Like, it's not true. That would just anger me to hear that and that to be in my story. It's just really upsetting when someone could do all that to you and know they're doing it to you and then turn around and be like, no, I didn't do that.
If you knew he had to answer you honestly, that he wasn't going to just sort of shine you on, what question would you want to know the answer to? What would you want him to say to you that would explain something about this?
I just want to know why. Like, why? Why did you have pleasure from tormenting another human? Why? Doesn't make sense to me. I hope in his future he figures it out. Or else, whatever other relationships he's in, I feel bad for that girl.
What about the relationships you're going to be in?
I feel bad for them too.
Really?
I'm still learning. I'm really still learning. And at this point, I don't really feel like all the energy I put into him, I don't think I could do that for somebody else. Like, I feel drained. I feel like now is the time to focus on the things that I was neglecting, friends, family. I don't need a relationship to concentrate on another person. I've already wasted enough time.
Do you think you'll ever get to a point where you can think in a more healthy way about the possibility of being with someone for whatever reason?
Yeah, just when I'm ready. Once I'm in school and I'm settled and I feel good about the direction my life's going.
What do people take from your story that surprises you? What do they listen to and go, oh, that's the most amazing thing that you thought, oh, I didn't think that was that amazing.
I guess the only thing that's surprising is like this is one of the best stories of the year or all that. And I'm just like, that is so way over the top. And I don't know. I still feel very odd when people comment on the story. But besides being surprised, the only thing I was a little upset about was the comments towards my mom and the drug abuse. It's a little bit upsetting. Not surprising, I guess.
What's your mom think?
She hasn't listened to the story. I just kind of looked at her the other day when she asked to hear it. And I was like, Mom, do you really want to listen to the story? Like think, do you really want to listen to the story? She just looked at me and walked away.
What do you hope women get out of this story that you've told?
I hope women who are in it listen to it and know that they're not alone, that you can get out, that there are people who love you, people who want to help you. You just got to find them, or they'll find you. And then to family members or friends listening to the story, I just want them to take away that even if they're not there for you right now, or you might have anger for it, towards them for being absent, just that stick by them and be there for them because they need you.
Do you know how to do that for someone?
It doesn't seem like it from what I've done. My friends and family definitely hold a little bit of resentment toward me. I don't blame them. My brother, actually, when we got back, he kind of threw a little bit of a fit because his thoughts were that he was waiting for the day that I either got back with him or I got into a relationship with someone else who had the same problems. But it was a long time that I wasn't with them, and I'm lucky that my friends are even still my friends. Almost 5 years, that's a long time.
Never again?
Never again. Even when I think about it now, I just think of just bad memories. Everything was just bad. Like, I can't even remember anything good. I don't want to ever feel that way again.
What's next?
I'm just going to try to get a job where I'm living now. I'm living in Florida. I'm going to apply to college. And I'm just going to build myself until I'm ready. Like a caterpillar in its cocoon stage. And come out as a butterfly.
Rainey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can hear Rainey's full half-hour story at WNYC.org/radiorookies. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.